everyone to Miles on FM episode 5, today covering the fourth mini book of Cards and Moon titled Assassins, Part Chapter 11. So we basically open with a little poem that mentions the chalice, coin figure on chalice, which is obvious quote. Chalice.
Yeah, we don't get the reveal for that until a little bit later on, but I quite like the idea of the cup, the chalice sort of trolling the coin.
Yeah. Then in the opening poem of the chapter, we get this this restless soul, which is Patterson. They're going around finding these people who make barrows, which barrows are kind of like a theme in the series. I really don't know why.
Yeah, I think it's just like a burial mound, isn't it?
I know, there's always a barrow in every book.
Yeah. It's one of the Ericksonisms of the series, like the color ochre and things being gelid.
Color ochre?
Right.
What's the word? Ochre,
Ochre, yeah.
Yeah, but we're not up to date. Anyway, so the action chapter begins with yet another dream by Krupp. He's basically wandering around this whole crime out the world. Actually, this time he muses upon the significance of fire, and this time I think I got why, because in the previous chapter of Tool and the adjunct are talking about how life is fire, and the fire for Krupp symbolizes life. This dream is kind of all about
especially if he's on a frozen tundra with all that rotting ice around, he needs needs that fire for warmth.
Then he meets Swan, not an IMS yet, an IMS. That was actually an error in the book where it said he's a Swan now, soon he'll be an IMS. It's actually the other way around. IMS is the name of the race, and Swan signifies the undead. Anyway, so he's IMS now, but in the future he'll be a Swan. His name is Pran Chol. He's a bit of a significant character. He's talking about how, he affirms to Krupp that the beginning of the world is a bit not exactly true. I'm still a bit after all races, but relatively speaking, I guess, anyway.
Yeah, I mean, if there's flesh and blood IMS running around, then we're probably about 100,000 years ago or something crazy like that. Yeah. So not quite the beginning of time, but close enough for us, I think.
Anyway, so I'm kind of wondering how Pran is kind of aware of what's going on.
I think it's the nature of this sort of time traveling dream type thing where people know, Pran already knows that he's going to become an undead IMS, and he talks to Krul about it, and he knows that he's going to have to wait sort of hundreds of thousands of years before he'll meet the child again.
That's kind of odd because he's in this ancient form, right? Or he's undead. I don't know. That's not.
But I think it might be something like Pran's sort of consciousness has been sent back in sort of time, as it were, for the purpose of this dream. it's crazy and confusing, like so much in this series.
Yeah. And then now we meet this Rivi woman who's going to the vessel, which is kind of, did she volunteer for this? A bit of a draining experience.
I don't think we know yet, and I can't remember whether or not she volunteered, she's, even though she appears pregnant, she's not, she's just being prepared as a vessel in order to take this soul, so.
Well, he has been sleeping for the past how long? They meet this torn up body of a woman who I can only miss night you, and she's also important. Then finally, they meet this abominable flesh, Tattersail, and then it's kind of an odd thing for Stephen Erickson. He actually comes out and says it's Tattersail. I thought he would it's been a long time since I read this. So I thought it was a subtle thing that you find out in the movie, but actually not.
No, I think at this point he's kind of playing it straight that it's just Tattersail in there.
It says a Krupa says Tattersail, you're born third. That's a weird ritual to get soul into Rivi's body. For some reason, she has the soul to shape she wanted. Maybe because she's soul shifted, out of her body to die.
Yeah, it could also be if she becomes sort of effectively a bone caster of the Talanimas, then they're all shapeshifters, aren't they? So
Yeah, and then we have Riri woman gives birth to a baby with white fur. That is actually pretty fast. I don't know about the kind of feels really fast, like pump, 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 oh, the baby's
These Riri women know how to deliver a child, it seems. Although she is described as being middle-aged, so possibly she's had several children, and it's sort of no big deal for her at this point.
Yeah. I like the part at the end of the section. Friend, like, oh, I wish I could be a princess. Says, well, yeah, you have something to look forward to in 300,000 years.
Just sort of 300,000 years of sort of soul destroying eternity, and then you'll eventually get to meet the baby again. So at least there's some light at the end of the tunnel.
Humorous twist on one of the big themes of the series, which thing you see with fine mass, rate, stand the eye. Krupa put it in a little lighter notes.
And then we get Krupp talking to Krul about sort of what's going on back in Darujistan. Yeah. And Krupp reveals that he knows what Relic and Murillo are planning. We don't at this point, but old Krupp, he knows what's going on. He says he's going to turn their schemes to my purpose, and he sort of guilt rides this decision, but they are needed.
And now we go back to, I don't think we have some flashbacks, so much as a little shift to before his dream, what Krupp was doing that day. This is walking around the city. He mentioned that there's a cantrip. What is a cantrip? It seems to be some kind of like warp spell, but I remember that from like these old Dungeons and Dragons books with like those aesthetic kind of level zero spell.
I think it's like a sort of a trap or a ward type thing. It's just sort of a defensive sort of mechanism.
Like Dungeons and Dragons, silly spells you didn't have to wait for your mage to get into. I guess it just Erickson's looking for like that synonym, you know?
Yeah.
He did create the models on the Esselmont about developing a role playing. Yeah. So he's basically walking around this laborious described market, all kinds of people are selling stuff, the cosmopolitan city of Dujan. And he goes to Baruch, the alchemist, and they're both complaining about the road repair, which I find it kind of like weird, but in a cool way that like people in the fantasy world are like thinking, oh, I wish the repair people would stop, but like quiet. It's like kind of like an everyday kind of modern 21st century kind of thing to find here.
Yeah, the quarrels, the sort of things that people complain about down the ages don't really change that much. We complain about our family members, we complain about our co-workers, we complain about the weather and roadworks.
We complain about our allies.
Yeah. I think it's interesting that Krupp already knows that the road workers are Malazans.
Yeah.
Because he hears the Malazan curse when when he sees Baruch, he there's sort of like a mention of the road workers, and it kind of throws Krupp off balance, but he sort of thinks to himself that he knows who the Malazans are, but he's not ready to share that information with Baruch yet.
So we talk about coin bearers, that. Oh yeah, I like how like when he leaves the Baruch's house, he says, "Oh wait, I forgot something. Krupa forgot to close the door." Krupa runs. Krupa closes the door. Yay, Krupa closed the door.
Yeah.
I wonder why he talks to A to himself, B about himself in the third person. I wonder why it's a quirk, but
I think it's part because it amuses Erickson.
Yes.
and it's just sort of a sort of comedy style of that particular character. And also I think it's sort of part of he's got kind of a weird magic about him. That doesn't seem to sort of express itself in terms of sort of majory, but he does sort of have this kind of air of sort of confusion around him, and I don't know if referring to himself in the third person is sort of part of his.
What about it? He basically tries to like create this veneer of idiots, lovable fat idiots, which is actually a pretty smart plan. People get noticed generally stabbed at night.
But when we have Sori following him and she sees his hand sort of flying out as a blare, and it looks like it's just an affectation, but as he's doing it, little pastries and various other bits of food are sort of flying off the stands into into his pockets, waiting in his sleeve.
Maybe he just uses magnets for a while, I don't know. Then we have like a sudden point of view shift to Whiskey Jack, who is working with the other bridge burners. They're posing as road workers, when in reality they're mined to go off the various intersections. The soldiers are settling into their roles rather too well.
Yeah.
It's disturbing how well they Fiddler is with. And we have another of one of the trademarks of this specific road movie, about how sorry. In this case, Whiskey Jack says how he sees his soul withered, sorry eye.
Yeah. It's great when we get to see sort of how much of a tortured soul Whiskey Jack is, and the responsibility he feels towards his men and towards the Empire, and how he just sees how sort of this life as a soldier has just destroyed his soul, and he sees in sort of the innocent face of Sorry with the dead eyes, he sees sort of that sort of played out in front of him.
Like, she's so old. In reality, she's so old. She walked into the blood moon at the dawn of time. I think I'm jumping a bit, but when Callum, talking about Whiskey Jack, Callum and Quick Ben are talking a bit later about why they can't stop and lose, no one will convince Whiskey Jack, but I'm not exactly sure what Whiskey Jack is loyal to. Is he loyal to seeing the idea of the Empire?
I think it is the idea of an Empire. I think he's sort probably. Of bought into the Empire, to the old Emperor's vision, and he's just kind of maybe feels like it's too late in life for him to sort of move on, and he's kind of in this thing for the long haul or something like that. He seems like the kind of guy who, once he sets himself on a course, he sort of sticks to it and sees it through whatever the cost.
After this section, we ship Crocus, there's the escapade, and it kind of put me off when his uncle Mammoth says, oh, I think stealing is okay because you own something, you should protect it. That kind of put me off because Mammoth is really a bad guy, and our conception is not okay, which I guess could be just reflect, you know, how the smiles on books reflect quite a great morality, even more so than I said I've done.
Yeah, although to be fair to Mammoth, the reason that he thinks that stealing's okay is that basically he rejects the notion of ownership and property and stuff like that, so it's not like he's sort of... it's still a pretty cutthroat kind of attitude for this sort of kindly old man about, well, you know, if you want something, you should defend it.
Basically, the context is Mammoth is telling Crocus that he could steal it, but he move on to Verity. Scholar, sort.
Mm-hmm.
Crocus says, oh, well, maybe they think, oh, if I'm a scholar and I become like accept society, then Jaleesa will notice me. And then we get one of the very few incidents in the series, Mammoth's great story about the three first races of Corcoroseto, the Climbing Mass, and the Jaguar. Crocus, we were talking about how Darujistat was founded on the rumor that one of the Jaguar was buried in the area. Actually, one of the poems quoted in this book is called The Rumorborn, so from the city. Yeah. And actually, until now, we don't really know that the Climbing Mass region kind of does clarify why the present and also the past. Like the end of the they're known some Climbing Mass. One thing I didn't get is, like, he says that Mama says that today the Port Cruel Sale are called the Crew Sale, and I don't recall ever hearing that.
No, it's that nickname, as far as I recall, never comes up again. I'm not sure about referring to the Jagoth as Sherl.
Sherl, no. Jag, yes. But I think Jags are like half Jag.
Yeah, I thought a Jag was like a half breed.
It's a Godamus term, kind of part of something first book kind of dropped later. His entangles, a lot of time points.
Yeah.
Still, it's a kind of a cool window in the other paths. So taken, maybe though, I think we'll find out in the start. Anyway, moving on. I liked how in the marketplace there's like there's these 1,000 sects of the god Direk, and each one of them has their own icon. at the risk of a pop, and yet another pop culture reference, I'll say, reminds that part of the life of Brian. Follow the gourd! No, follow the holy sandal! Everyone has their own icon of Direk. Yeah. So we're again in Sorry, Chief, and Whiskey Jack says that man who passed proof of that seer, it triggered something in her mind. We know that's probably the Riga of seer.
Yeah.
He's talking about it. Set off something like her deception itself, the god, death, and cotillion, anyway, kind of starts to shatter, and she has a bit of an identity crisis. So she's walking around, and she, near the Phoenix Inn, she meets this guy who's like, oh, girls shouldn't carry swords. And it's kind of weird because you don't encounter a lot of that kind of sex in the Muslim women as far as I at least noticed, but I guess can't expect that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I don't know how much sort of gender equality there is in sort of the Jenna Bacchus.
Yeah,
I know that the Malazans, the Malazan Empire really is almost a perfect sort of meritocracy. Anyone can, regardless of whether they're male, female, foreign or sort of native national of the empire, they can all go as high as they can based on their ability and sort of how hard they work and how good they are at what they do, which is sort of really interesting to see in a sort of supposedly ancient culture that they're in many ways sort of ahead of even our own sort of enlightened 21st century society.
At least in that respect, yeah, anyway. So she has a bit of an extreme reaction. She just takes her sword or knife out and walks into the dead. I guess it's just she's just in a bad mood.
I think perhaps she needed to reaffirm the fact that she is Cotillion, just by dropping a guy dead just for looking at her the wrong way. It's just, you know, one flick of the wrist and he's got a knife in the eye.
Yeah, bye.
So she goes into the inn, and we've got this young boy being hung upside down, being beaten with sticks by the two bar women, I think. Oh. when she goes into the Phoenix Inn, it's what they got? Is it Mies and Irilta or something like that? And they've got some young boy swinging from his feet, and they're hitting him with sticks just for their amusement, I think. And then they see Sari coming in, and one of them says, you know, you get in any trouble, ask for us, we'll look after you.
Yeah, that's...
And I wouldn't mess with those two. They're
no, I really wouldn't. Yeah.
Pretty formidable.
then he sees Crocus. There's a bit of a weird thing when everyone's, like, playing cards. Basically, they're like drunk calls saying, oh, you know, we're allowed to Moon Spawn now. And it was like, what? Oh, you know what's in Moon Spawn? Five Flash Dragons!
Yeah.
We're not the only ones who are wondering how that was about. In the next chapter there, we have everyone's wondering.
Yeah, it comes out of nowhere, and we never really find out if that was just sort of Cole remembering something that someone had said to him a long time ago, an old sort of tale, and he just shouts it out, or if someone's speaking through him, or...
Yeah. So,
but it's certainly a strange outburst from the old drunk.
Chapter 12, we open with Kripa reading the book, and it's the first mention of our old friend, Kripa God.
Yeah, this is a great bit of foreshadowing here.
Yeah.
We get a sort of telling of the tale that forms the background of much of the series.
Yeah.
And we get some cool name drops. Hood and Decembre and five black dragons and one
red. Black dragons, yeah. And then Krupa is annoyed because it's taking so long to find needed, because apparently this one book is the DIR. So finally he says, oh, probably my grandmother's name is going to be on the next.
Yeah.
So finally he finds a mention from the DI and Amanda Ray. And
I love Mammoth's reaction when Krupp's complaining about the lack of brevity in this passage. He says, such long-lipped dribbles common to these ancient scholars are a curse that Krupp is thankful to find extinct in our time. And Mammoth sort of turns away coughing.
Then Krupp becomes a total hypocrite and starts ranting about how he helped Krupp.
Yeah.
I would help him in deadly alleys. And, yeah.
That's what's so great. It's like Krupp of all people to complain about someone else going on. It's a startling lack of self-awareness.
Maybe the reason we're doing this really is we'll find out, like, go to the net, how first. We talk a bit, Krupa gets information about Moon Spawn, and then we have a scene in Baruch, he has a conversation with Krone.
Yeah, I like the way Baruch handles himself here. He's not sort of come crawling to Rake and sort of doing everything he says without question. He's sort of saying, you know, well, what's going on here? Crone's complaining that Baruch hasn't helped Rake yet. And he says, well, he hasn't asked for any help. He hasn't told me what's going on. How can I help him?
Yeah. Then at the end of the scene, he like magically summoned both Krupa and
Mammoth.
Yeah, the Mammoth. works then, which I kind of put, like, he opens a war and says their names appear there.
Yeah, it's funny because we get the same chap, we get the same scene from Barak's perspective later, and he's only looking for Mammoth, and when he goes in, he sees Krupp sitting opposite him, and he's like, ah, perfect, I'll take you both, please.
Yeah, I was wondering, though, what is Krupp is one? You mentioned, he's like, talking about Krupp is one, I wonder what this one is.
I don't know if he's sort of got command of a warren as such, or if he's just this sort of natural force. But he seems sort of dream aspected, so possibly he's got some connection to the Queen of Dreams, but
who knows, dude. I think that one of those Stephen Erickson's AMAs, maybe once when someone, and every one of those someone asks, what is Krupp? He always says, Krupp is Krupp.
Yeah.
he's kind of like Yoda in that his own speech. Then we shift to Kellan Quickben, and they mention that it's that scene where the Quickben goes to the Warren of Shadow.
Yeah, and he's being escorted by the hounds, and he knows them all.
Yes, which is cool.
Cool little detail.
Sense does, he used to be an acolyte in the north in the Shadow Court, and basically sells Hairlock out or not. Yeah, not for it all.
Hey, Hairlock had it coming, man. That guy's out of control. I love this scene between Quickben and Shadow Throne. It was one of the sort of moments in the book where I really sort of got hooked. Just this idea of sort of gods and mortals sort of making deals and sort of trying to outmaneuver each other and something very, very Greek about it.
Yes, exactly. Well, I don't know if they do actually make a direct deal with the gods in mythology, but you do have those not all powerful, always steaming gods. Yeah, which is cool. And there's a bit later where Callum says Quickben says how the world would be so much better if there were no priests, because then the gods couldn't fear it. It's a cool bit about mesotheism.
Yeah, but what would happen to all of Quickben's power if there was no gods? Would the Warrens still work and all the rest?
they basically exploit the Warrens. head to meet up the Assassin's Guild team. We have two sides in this chapter. Yeah, on one side, Akalot on the and Ralaknam on the Assassin's side, and then we have Kalan and Quickben on the Bridgman side. And the book kind of like tricked me here, even on the reading, because I thought like, oh, that's why he told the Ralak to like make it obvious that he's assassin, because they want to make a deal with the attractive Bridgman to make a deal. But then later trap.
Yeah.
Maybe it's just me. Then there's the little quip from Kalan. Sometimes I get a feeling that the Empire wants us dead.
Yeah, very droll.
It's even said that. So he says it dryly. Yeah, the big battlesome soon erupts, but he shifted to Crocus, who, after having gone stolen games back from Kent, he's now going, he goes to Chalice's room one night and to put them back. And she's a pretty sassy girl. Actually, she wakes up, she says, oh, well, if you're putting you back, you should put that jewelry thing right there, and there, he starts giving command, and she says, well, I'm not your victim anymore, obviously, because you might pack my stuff, like that.
Yeah, and that's when she reveals that her name's Chalice, which just sort of calls back to the start of the book, where we heard about the coin in the chalice. So.
Yeah, chalice. and basically she says that she actually apparently like sympathizes, and she tells him to run and be careful with tripwire stuff. So, interesting. She doesn't seem all that hostile.
Well, I think, you know, she's a teenage girl of similar age to Crocus. She probably finds the idea of a sort of a thief coming into her bedroom in the night to return stolen stuff to be quite romantic, quite exciting.
Yeah.
She's probably used to these sort of council fops. Yeah. Someone who's a bit rough, bit of danger. She probably finds that sort of quite appealing, but at the same time beneath her.
The funny thing is that Crocus actually wants to be one of those council fops. And he even says, like, oh, I'm Crocus Younger, and you're going to see me to all the suitors. Which I hope we can kind of understand a bit self-conscious about that, at least.
Mm.
Kalam and Quickben get into a sticky situation, both the guild and unknown other people attacking. So in the end, he like shatters this bottle and a demon comes out of it. And he's a bit of a tragic demon.
Pearl. Poor Pearl.
Yeah. It's like, so basically he talks to the Quick Ben before it's like, I run out of this. So last thing he says, like, Quick Ben Daylight, do you pity me? Yes. And then Ben jumps.
Yeah, it's, I think it's...
Poor guy.
It's the way Erickson sort of instantly sort of gives this demon humanity, sort of makes it into a sympathetic character, which is just a complete inversion of the sort of normal tropes that we get around demons and fantasy of being sort of mindless beings of evil. And I think we find out demons in this universe are just foreigners who've been dragged in against the will.
Exactly. it's just a blanket term for everyone from Muggins. One's a Corvala demon, Pearl, one's the one that Night Chill. In fact, you just reminded me of a talk that's quite far too. Sorry.
Yeah. Anyway. And it's the fact that Ben's already said that, you know, one of these Corvalari demons could level a city if it so chose. And then he still sort of makes it a sort of tragic little figure being sent to its doom against someone very powerful.
Yeah, and in fact, in the next scene, we shift to Moonspawn, actually, and we find out that the unknown people tried to count Ben were actually Tista and the Ivory, and apparently they killed Pearl in less than minutes. That one of them was killed, the poisoned art, and Rake, in fact, in this chapter, Rake, in both the missing and the one at the end of the chapter where he talks to Baruch, kind of comes up as actually a bit more of a villain than he does there earlier on. Like he gives them 3 days off, it kind of gets the feeling that he doesn't care that much anyone else on.
Yeah, I think his character goes through a bit of change through the series, because I think Erickson probably envisioned him as being sort of an antagonist, sort of villain.
But even in this type character, he's more ambiguous than that. I mean, even though in this chapter we kind of get, everyone notices the tragedy core and the sword. We hear first about how there's a wagon and stuff inside a sword. It's a tragedy core. That's why we keep hearing this horrible wagon noise.
The creaking of wheels and the shaking of chains.
Yeah. as I said, following up from the previous conversation, it turns out that he found that Rake found those two mages pale, and he's still creepy.
He received the heads, didn't he? And then when he asks Baruch about it, he said, you know, were they willing? And he goes, when I explained what the alternative was, they agreed to be decapitated.
Oh, yeah.
And Rake just has like a sort of soft chuckle to himself.
Yeah, that came off.
Yeah, that comes off. He sort of does have times where he seems really cold and really heartless. And then, but we kind of get to see why he's like that, because there's sort of the pressures of leadership and Whiskey Jack, who sort of wears his despair on his sleeve, Rake puts out a sort of a much more confident, assured persona.
No, that's a good point for the parallel book about the harsh leadership. And in fact, speaking of Whiskey Jack, he has a bit of a pretty beautiful sequence where he basically reminisces about armor and his first sword, which then he lifts his first battle, still had the chalk of his father's mind
on his boots, yeah.
Yeah, his armor has his old blood on him, and it records all the cuts and wounds he's ever received. It's quite a good paragraph there. And then he watches a non-existent card game between Edge and Mallet. They're playing cards in the job with Jack, and misses it, wakes up, and that he goes over and asks what they're playing, and Fuller's like, what should I know? We're just standing here.
Yeah, Quick Ben joins the game, and he's like, all right, it's a game of patience, is it? And he just like puts his hands behind his back and stretches legs. He's like, I can wait all day. And that kind of reminds me of the card game we had. I think it was a card game earlier in the book with Krupp and the guys at the Phoenix Inn. And they're all waiting for Krupp to take his turn, and instead he's spinning out this ridiculously long and complicated tale to the point where everyone else gives up and concedes that Krupp wins the game without casting a single card.
That's
yeah. If you've got nowhere to be, and you know other people have got places to be going, then just wait it out.
And And then there's a little like, sorry, Whiskey Jack says, he watched the non-existent card game. Which is a cool way of Eric's place. So yeah, that pretty much does it for another short mini book, even though I think the next one, book 5, The Gat Reveals, is even shorter.
Yeah.
Shorter will probably be also doing all of it next episode. So obligatory reminders, if you still haven't liked on Facebook, search Facebook Moz on the podcast and like us. You know, we should be bringing back the chat for me.
Yeah.
That would add a dropped. Anyway, we also have a blog, of course, milesonthem.blogspot.com and iTunes and Stitcher?
Stitcher.
Yes.
Yeah. All the usual places you can get your podcasts.
So you have absolutely excuse to be not be updated on the podcast. So.
Well, they've got lots of excuses, just not relating to the availability of it.
don't tell them that.
Alright, well, and I think, I've gotta say, it's really considerate the way Erickson wrote this first book in nice digestible chunks that we can do in an episode each. I don't know what we're gonna do when we get to the next book, and it goes to the traditional, four book, format, but, we'll see.
Two, three chapters, I'm a part of much of that.
Yeah.
Although in the last book, worked a bit similarly, but.
Long way to get before we get there.
Oh yeah.
Alright, well, thanks very much for listening, everyone. And thank you, Jonathan. And I'll speak to you all next week.
Next week.
Oh, that's in 2 weeks.
We could always help.